This podcast is part of the Bomb Pod Media Network.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
You know, when this happened, I don't know what it was in me, but very, very early on, I remember just trying to come to grips and to terms with it, and, you know, just never thinking I was going to figure out who did that to her. And then also very scared of what would happen if I tried to figure it out, you know, and the fact that it would consume me, and that in some ways would give whoever killed her even more, you know, than they'd already taken.
After the murders of Mildred May in 1967, Becky Martin in 1973, and Carla Walker in 1974, all in the months of February, another homicide took place in 1977 on that very month. The fourth and final victim in what the press referred to as the February slayings was June Ward. Her case was the least covered, her murder resulting in only a few short articles in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and Cleburne Times Review. The original investigation turned up little. Daryl Thompson, a Fort Worth police detective at the time, told us that there just wasn't anything there, that June had car issues, and that they felt it may have been a migrant worker, an opportunist. It has been said that the case went cold almost as soon as the murder happened, but the lack of information and evidence does not mean that June or her case deserves less attention. Johnson County, Texas, sits due south of Tarrant County. The county seat, Cleburne, is virtually in the direct center. The heart of the town is about 32 miles directly south of Fort Worth. Cleburne began as a Civil War outpost called Camp Henderson, where military units would be dispatched to battle or other military exercises. The then tiny town wouldn't be officially named Cleburne until 1868. At that time, the population was only 7,500, but by the late 1970s, the population had slowly grown to about 18,000. The once agricultural center of Johnson County began to boom into a large town only after Santa Fe Railroads opened major machining operations there in 1898. June Merlene Mulder was born in Cleburne on July 28, 1951, to Mary Catherine, age 34, and William Othell Mulder, age 52. William worked in the rail car department of the Santa Fe Railroad. June was essentially an only child at the time of her birth because her older brother from her father's previous marriage was 29 years older than her. With her nephews nearer in age, June became very close to them. So close, in fact, that their relationships were more akin to that of siblings.
My grandfather had a kid in the 20s, got divorced, and then in the 50s, got remarried. And the same time his son was having kids, had my mom. So even though she was their aunt, technically, they were all the same age. And they, for a number of years, they actually lived right next door to each other. And, you know, I can imagine, I mean, they cared about her quite a bit and looked, you know, took care of her and were in some ways big brothers to her.
Cleburne was a picturesque archetype of a Southern American country town during June's childhood years. Everyone loved the sweet-natured and outgoing girl, and even as June blossomed into a young woman, you'd be hard-pressed to find an individual who would speak negatively about her.
We were in the same grade, and we went to the same school from grade school on up. We used to play a lot together, and on the weekends, I had a horse, and I would ride by her house and then some of my other friends' house. And it was kind of like my horse and I used to go visit all of my friends. She was in Bluebirds with us. She was always just the sweetest, quietest little girl. She was just different. Like, there was something special about her. And we all played together and did jump rope and kickball at Irving School. And I don't know. She just had something special about her. I've never heard anything bad about her or, you know, her growing up or getting into mischief or anything like that. Maybe it just never dawned on her that she could or would, because it was just, she was just a good person in my eyes, seeing as how I had that relationship with her as a child.
Perhaps closest to June was her best friend, Dorothy. The two became inseparable in junior high after an incident that provides a clear example of June's character.
I met June in seventh grade. The school was Fulton Junior High in Cleburne. Cleburne's just this little small town. You know, you could run around in it and stuff and never have to worry about anybody hurting you or anything like that. But anyway, we just started seventh grade, and I was walked into the class. June was already sitting. I dropped my books. All the kids started laughing and thinking it was funny. But June, she got out of her chair, walked over, and helped me pick up my books. She said, "Don't mind them," and she smiled. After class, I thanked her, and before we knew it, we were best friends. One Friday after school, June asked me if I wanted to go to the movies with her and her mom on a Saturday. Well, I went to meet June at the movies, and her mom was a really sweet lady. And then I walked home with him, and I met her dad. He was an older man, and he was legally blind. I don't know, after that, June and I, we just started hanging out together, and we just became really best friends. We just did almost everything possibly, you know, that we could do. And like I said, it was just a small town, and we could walk all over town. She lived on the north side, and then I lived on the south side, so we would meet in the middle, which was town. And we'd just walk all over town on, you know, on Saturdays and try on clothes if we wanted to. All the salespeople knew we wasn't going to buy them, but, you know, they didn't care if we, you know, put them on. And we just act silly like, you know, kids do. June never met a stranger. She talked to everybody. I was a little shy person. But June, she never met a stranger. And she always had something nice to say about somebody. I never ever heard her say anything bad about anyone. We even met guys and stuff at the movies one time and started dating them. They were brothers. One's name was Teddy and the other one was Gary. We even double dated a few times. June was kind of crazy about Teddy, but I wasn't real crazy about Gary. I didn't go with him very long. And then eventually she met Mike Ward. I don't know, after that, well, it was just June, Mike, and I. We all hung out. I had a boyfriend, but it was kind of an on-again, off-again thing. But she and Mike, they hung out together, and she's just a sweet person. I don't know what else to say. I mean, I just never met anybody like her and probably never ever will. I just loved her like a sister.
The two did almost everything together. They were even married in a joint ceremony.
When my boyfriend asked me to marry him, I couldn't wait to tell June, but I had to make my boyfriend go in there and talk to my dad, because that's what they did back in the day. But anyway, he was real scared. He didn't want to do that, but for me, he did. And my daddy didn't make it easy for him. He asked him all kinds of crazy questions. He just kept on it until it was almost 12 o'clock. I wanted to call June. She was the first one I wanted to talk to, you know, and tell her about it, because I was so excited. And by the time that we had finished up with my dad, it was 12 o'clock, and June's mom, she didn't like calls that, you know, late or anything, so I knew I better not call her. So I waited till the next morning. As soon as I got up, and I called her, and she was asleep. And that just really aggravated me. It was like, oh, you got to get up, you know. But her dad says, no, she's sleeping. I'll have her call you whenever she wakes up. So when she finally did, she was so excited for me, and we were laughing and cutting up like girls do. Anyway, I told her, I said, hey, I said, you and Mike, I said, y'all been talking marriage. I said, what about us having a double wedding? And she got really excited, and she said, oh, I'd love that. And I said, yeah, me too, because I don't want to stand up there by myself, you know. that's what we decided to do. But I told her she better talk to Mike, and I knew I'd have to talk to Danny about it. And we did, and the guys was fine with it. We just wanted, you know, just something kind of small, but we definitely a church wedding. My dad, he told me he wasn't going to buy me a big wedding dress, which I didn't want anyway. And she decided that, you know, we'd just go and get us some dresses. So that's what we did. I had a banquet dress that I actually wore. It's kind of a turquoise, and June picked out a really cute one. We went to town the next day, and she got her a little white dress with little white daisies in it. You know, what's going to do? We're just going to invite a few friends and mostly relatives, you know. And that's the kind of wedding we had. But before the wedding, the preacher was 2 hours late. That's not a good sign. it gave the guys too much time to, you know, back out. So we were kind of worried about that. When he finally did come in, instead of taking June and Mike up there, you know, first, and then, you know, and then coming, you know, and getting me and Danny later, he just lined all four of us up. We didn't know what to think about that. But anyway, that's what he did. And all time that he was saying, do you take this one or do you take that one? He was getting us all mixed up. So June and I, we laughed after it was over with and said, wonder who we married, you know. he kept saying, Dorothy, do you take Mike? And Mike take Dorothy, you know, and Danny, do you take June? And then we was like, no, that's not right. You know, we had to keep telling him. We really didn't know. And so we kind of was waiting for our wedding certificates and everything to come in. When they did, because, you know, we didn't know, you know, what he had put on there. But he got the names right. it was a lot of fun. And we always had a lot of fun together. Anything that we wanted to do, it seemed like we just ended up laughing all the time.
June, last name now Ward, became pregnant while in high school. And although she dropped out to have her son, David, she obtained her GED shortly thereafter so that she could seek a nursing degree. Though Mike and June's marriage didn't work out, providing for David was June's priority. Having attended a nursing program at Hill County Junior College in Cleburne, June completed her residency at Johnson County Memorial Hospital. She was licensed as a vocational nurse. She'd worked as a nurse at John Peter Smith Hospital and the Edna Gladney Home, both in Fort Worth, but was unemployed and still residing in Cleburne in February of 1977. David remembers his mom's hardships as a young mother, but has even more vivid recollections of their bond.
Well, yeah, she was really young when she had me. Now that I kind of know the story, her, you know, my dad, whom I never really grew up or remember being around, my. And I don't fault them either, right? They're very, you know, literally still in high school and briefly tried to make it happen and that fell apart. And so, you know, very quickly ended up just being me and my mom and then living with her dad, my grandfather, who was really kind of my, you know, looking back, my father figure in my life. But, you know, she was obviously, not only did I love her, but, you know, very obviously like everybody kind of loved her. And she had one of the personalities that, you know, and she struggled, and she had a hard time, you know, again, she was young and still trying to, you know, be a young woman and also be a mother. And it's interesting. I have, you know, the memories I have of her are, you know, they're like, instead of like a nice and neat photo journal or photo book, you know, it's just a bunch of snapshots that are thrown into a box, you know? And so there's really kind of no order or no kind of, there's nothing written on the back of any of them. So I just have these memories, and I don't know who the people are. I don't know where I was, or really, frankly, like if I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. So there's all these little snapshots of memories, you know, and a lot of them, you know, a lot of them really good. You know, she was really proud of me. And one of my fondest memories of, again, it's the 70s, so you have to give her a break, but I remember her picking me up from school and sitting on my $6 million man lunchbox in the front seat of the car unrestrained. And she's got the radio cranked, and I'm sticking my head out the window, singing at the top of my lungs to the song on the radio. And you know, if there was a friend in the car, she would brag about that. You know, I would know all the lyrics to the song after just hearing it, you know, a couple of times. And that of course made me real proud, but just, you know, lots of little memories like that.
Even at 26, June Ward was petite, standing only 5 feet, 2 inches tall, and weighing 125 pounds. On Thursday, February 17th, June dropped her son off at the Cleburne YMCA, where he was to compete in a boxing tournament. David kissed his mother and got out of the car. June headed to Fort Worth to meet a Haltom City man she'd been recently dating, but stopped first at a Cleburne drive-in to grab a bite to eat at around 7 p.m., according to witnesses. Sometime around 3 a.m., now February 18th, police were dispatched to the 4800 block of the South Freeway Service Road to investigate an abandoned vehicle. The 1973 white, two-door Chevrolet Laguna was blocking the thoroughfare. It was locked, and police found a pair of women's shoes and jumper cables in the vehicle on the back seat floorboard. It appeared as though the car had stalled, and the driver abandoned the auto as a result. At approximately 4:30 a.m., a passing motorist caught a glimpse of what looked like a body lying on a curb of the road in the 1000 block of West Fuller Avenue as he sped past. The driver had just come from a nearby cafe, where he sat drinking coffee and making small talk with two Fort Worth police officers. He turned his vehicle around and confirmed that it was indeed a body and rushed back to the cafe from which he came to alert the officers he'd just spoke with. The body belonged to June Ward, as did the abandoned Chevy Laguna found just prior to the discovery. June was found nude, wearing only what was described as a gold necklace, on the early morning of Friday, February 18th, 1977. A brassiere strap was found clenched around her neck. There was no sign of June's clothing or personal items, including a bluish-green blouse, blue jeans, a small brown leather purse, and her car keys. It was speculated that June also might have been wearing a red leather jacket, missing a button on the front, white sandals, and two rings. The immediate area provided no clues or evidence as to what happened to the young mother. It was determined that she was killed at another location and subsequently dumped at the site where she was found. David was told that his mother was gone shortly after waking up.
Yeah, so the night, and I guess looking back, this is probably my lens to my belief that there's, you know, something beyond death. But the night my mother died, the last time I saw her, she had dropped me off at the YMCA, in Cleburne, and that was the last time I saw her. And when I got back to Cleburne, a friend's parents took me back home and I went to bed. And then at some point in the night, I remember waking up and she was at the door. And she came to me and she said goodnight and she tucked me in. And I woke up the next morning. And when I woke up, that's when my grandfather told me, briefly or basically what had happened to my mother and that she was gone. And again, I was waking up and I just remember being in a little bit of shock and disbelief and disoriented because I remembered her tucking me in. And as I kind of woke up, I realized that it actually had happened a couple of times previously in the night. And then I also remembered that she was, you know, when she came to me, she was dressed as a nurse, which obviously she wasn't working that night. And of course I think that took me a little bit of time to kind of piece those together that, you know, what I'd experienced was, you know, maybe not a literal thing that had happened, but, you know, it was also very hard to accept it because I just knew she'd been there the night before. You know, obviously that kind of thing sticks with you. But when I got older and old enough to really kind of, you know, I guess, do research and you know, do homework on such things, I did do some reading and, you know, and it turns out that's actually a relatively common phenomenon for loved ones to come to other loved ones, you know, when they pass. And again, I think that, you know, really the main thing that does for me is just, you know, that's a memory I have of her, whether it's, you know, real or literal or physical or not. But it also kind of gives me, you know, in spite of, I guess, doubts about a lot of things, it really kind of gives me at least some modicum of faith that, that there is something afterwards, because in some form or fashion, I truly believe she came to me that night.
Officers wasted little time showing June's photo to nearby businesses, though any clues they obtained doing this are unknown. The service road where the Chevy Laguna was found was just adjacent to a shopping center that contained a Kmart department store and a nightclub called Mr. Magoo's. It was at the corner of the South Freeway Service Road and Felix Street. Though many have speculated that June had been at Magoo's that night, it could never be definitively determined. It seems unlikely, as many of June's friends have said that she did not go to the establishment, and questioning of the clientele, which consisted mostly of regular customers, could not place her there. June's family told police that she had experienced car trouble in the preceding few weeks and was carrying the jumper cables for that reason. A helicopter was dispatched and aerial photographs were taken of a perimeter surrounding the 1,000 block of West Fuller, as well as a perimeter around where the vehicle was found, but the distance covered on either area was not specified. June's father told police that she was going on a date with her boyfriend, who resided in Haltom City. Police later questioned him, but little is known of where June and the Haltom City man had been or what they had done during their date. According to the man, June left him at approximately 11:30 p.m. to head back to Cleburne. He was quoted by the Fort Worth Star-Telegram as saying, "She might have stopped to eat after the date, so presumably the two had not dined during their rendezvous." He was cleared. Chief Medical Examiner Felix Gwotes determined the manner of death was asphyxiation by strangulation, and that there was no direct indication that June had been sexually assaulted. However, John Underwood, a crime scene investigator at the Monroe County Sheriff's Office in Florida, and a classmate of June's from elementary to high school, tells us that there was semen found on her body. Though the strangulation killed June, the perpetrator then bludgeoned the woman, mostly in the head, but also on the body, with what has been called a sharp, heavy object, consistent with a hatchet or axe. They were able to ascertain such because little bleeding occurred as a result of the bludgeoning. The fingers on June's right hand were broken, indicating that an intense struggle was likely. "There was definitely a struggle," John Underwood told the Cleburne Times-Review years later. "I think she fought to the end," he added. June's body was described as mutilated.
So this person spent quite a bit of time in the commission of this monstrous act. The very idea that someone would take that girl and do that, that's a monster. And I have daughters and granddaughters that I worry about constantly. Well, these days, you gotta keep them close. But there are monsters among us.
After seeing the reports in the paper, a man called Fort Worth police on Monday, February 21st, to report seeing a hatchet over the weekend in the parking lot of the Kmart near where June's automobile was found. Police were unable to locate the item, let alone confirm that the hatchet was ever there. The object used as a weapon would ultimately be theorized to be a carpenter's hatchet, or rigger's axe, a tool that has a hammer on one end and a hatchet on the other. June's homicide was cold almost as soon as it occurred. Lack of evidence, motive, witnesses frustrated the Fort Worth police from the beginning. It was unfathomable to June's family and friends that anyone would want to cause harm to the beloved mother, daughter, sister, and aunt.
I remember even when she died, I remember my grandfather just at a loss for everything. Just, I remember him saying, "I just don't understand it. Everybody who knew her just loved her. I don't know why anybody would do this to her."
And, you know, there's so many things she didn't get to see or experience or and whatever. But then on the flip side of that, David didn't get to spend time with his mother, you know, as far as growing up, with him graduating and him doing well in school or getting married or, you know, getting his first job or all of those things. So, you know, there's so many people that lose in that situation. So it's a ripple effect.
It broke my heart, you know, when she passed. And I'm going to cry. That I just missed her so bad, and it's just, I don't know, it's just not right.
Young David pushed up a chair to the radio in the kitchen at their home and awaited updates that would never come. He was stunned. He couldn't speak. Of course, his mom's passing would have an effect on him for the rest of his life as he struggled to understand why she was taken from him.
Well, I'd say, like, losing your parent, losing your mom, or even I'll go as far as say, like, a boy losing their mom and their only mom, and a mom they adore for, you know, even if she's not perfect, you know, it really is the gift that keeps giving. And it's unfortunately, when that happened to her, I don't know quite the rhyme or reason, but neighbors or friends had given my family a collection of newspaper clippings. You know, obviously Cleburne, and I guess at that time, Fort Worth, they weren't, you know, super big towns. So these were, you know, it's kind of a big event that makes the news. And unfortunately, like at that time, soon after that happened, I was privy to a lot of the things that happened to her and how she died. And, you know, it just leaves a mark, you know. It's, you know, I can't compare it, you know, that's the only internal loss I have. But, you know, it was very violent. And, you know, it exposes you to, I guess, a side of humanity that, you know, you hope you're never exposed to. Somebody can be that, I don't know, you can use the term evil and that would be every right. There's probably other terms for it, but it you know, really just, it leaves a big mark. And, you know, looking back as, you know, and then knowing a little, having kids of my own and, you know, just experiencing their kind of developmental journey, I say it's the gift that keeps on giving, because, you know, when you're 8 years old, you can only process so much. And then you hit, you know, the next developmental phase, and you know, and then something else occurs to you. And then there's, on top of that, for me, you know, I had to leave my top behind. It was kind of, you know, he's my father figure, and I left. He was, you know, an old man, and I think it was the term, he wasn't really in a position to take care of me, so I had to move with family. So I lost my mom, and then shortly thereafter, I lost him, or effectively lost him, because I didn't live with him anymore. And so there was guilt of leaving him behind, but. You know, and then when, you know, you hit your teenage years, and that for me personally, that's when it kind of, you know, started to unravel. And then, you know, honestly, by the time I was, you know, 25, I was really just kind of a mess and at a loss for what to do with myself. But, you know, when this happened, I don't know what it was in me, but very, very early on, I remember just trying to come to grips and to terms with it, and, you know, just never thinking I was going to figure out who did that to her. And then also very scared of what would happen if I tried to figure it out, you know, and the fact that it would consume me, and then in some ways would give whoever killed her even more, you know, than they'd already taken. You know, one of the things I think with tragedy and trauma is in some ways you start to identify with, and it becomes part of your identity. I'm Dave, you know, the guy who lost my mom brutally when I was 8 years old.
June's romantic interests were ruled out quickly, and the only other known person of interest came in the form of an incident that occurred shortly after her death in Haltom City. A 29-year-old white male was arrested for the abduction of a 19-year-old 7-Eleven night manager. The young woman was taken from the convenience store, located at 1325 North Beach Street. The man, wearing a brown paper bag on his head, walked into the store, carrying a can of chemical spray in one hand and a pocket knife in the other, at about 1 a.m., early Wednesday morning, February 23rd. He didn't ask for money, and instead forced the woman into the passenger seat of her own car. He climbed in after and began driving, holding a knife to the young woman's side. The man traveled south on 121 toward Fort Worth and turned south on the South Freeway. He stopped the car suddenly around the 12,000 block, and the young woman was able to escape the vehicle unharmed. She called police from an unknown location. The police retrieved her, and while returning to the store in the patrol car, she saw the man walking along the South Freeway service road. The suspect was arrested. The man was questioned in regard to June Ward's homicide, but was cleared by a polygraph test. Both the Fort Worth police detective who investigated June's case, Darrell Thompson, and John Underwood, Monroe County, Florida crime scene investigator, believe the perpetrator to have been a transient worker.
Some of my people that I knew back in Cleveland found out what I did. I'm a crime scene investigator. And they asked if I could find out anything about the case. When I called, it just so happened that the Fort Worth Police Department had reformed their cold case unit, and the young detective I spoke to had been put in the cold case unit from CSI. When I brought this case up to him in a telephone conversation, he looked it up enthusiastically, by the way, and told me that he was going to look for some of the evidence. He found it, and yes, they were able to extract a male DNA profile from some of the evidence they had left over. I was never informed whether it was semen from her underwear or whether it was epithelial skin cells from the article of clothing that he used to strangle her. And they ran that as a test against what they knew at the time, a couple of guys that were prime suspects, and there was no match. They even got for one of those guys, they had to get a warrant to obtain a familial match from a surviving family member. I believe it was up in New York or New Jersey, somewhere like that. And it didn't match. And I've never seen the files. I've never been privy to the files, any of their reports. But at that particular time, there was a lot of building, a lot of expansion going on around South Fort Worth at the time. There was a big push for more suburbs, communities, some big, huge at the time. Shopping malls and offices and corporate headquarters were all building to the south of Fort Worth. So there was a lot of transient labor in there at the time. All I had, or all I have now to go by, is just newspaper clippings. And I did note that they said she was bludgeoned with a hammer or an axe. And I spent a little time doing construction work, odd jobs. And one of the implements I thought I wanted to use until I tried it and hurt myself badly with it was a tool called a roofing hatchet, or a roofing hammer, specifically made for guys that nail down asphalt and cedar shingles. It has a hammer face on one side, but the backside, instead of being a claw to pull out nails, it's a small hatchet blade. And if it were a transient worker, for example, that would be the tool he would have with him. But again, I've never read the files, and I had no access to them whatsoever. In order to do a reconstruction, I had to have everything from witness statements, crime scene photos, crime scene reports, medical examiner's reports. You have to have all of those things in place to even consider a full-on reconstruction. As far as the DNA goes, the DNA wasn't well preserved because DNA wasn't even in anybody's vocabulary at the time she was murdered. At that time, all they had access to was blood typing. I'm just guessing here, and I'm not trying to make the detectives look bad, but they probably assumed that all of the blood there, because she had been brutally bludgeoned, was hers. When I began to look into it, most departments, even some large police departments, cannot afford to have a full-time dedicated cold case squad because they're so overwhelmed with new cases coming in. Homicide cases never close. There is no statute of limitations. They never close until the judge bangs the gavel and says, okay, this guy goes away for it, or the police can prove this guy that did this, he's died. He no longer exists. They never got back to me about what specific DNA profile they developed. I was only told very exuberantly that they had developed a male profile. And then later, maybe 6 months later, very disappointingly, was told that it did not match any of their suspects. I waited, maybe another 6 months, and contacted again, but their cold case unit was being run by a lady detective. I don't remember her name, but she was not very open to discussing anything with me. It's hard to know when you talk to someone on the phone. Am I talking to a detective or am I talking to a used car salesman that wants me to think he's a detective? So I understand her reluctance. And the last time I called, they no longer had a cold case unit even working. From my position as a CSI, I deal with physical evidence. And my evidence, it can sometimes be exculpatory, but evidence doesn't lie. The technology that you see reflected in the crime scene television shows, not just the documentary type, but the made-up ones, the technology you see presented, 99% of that is real. However, technology is pricey. I mean, very pricey. So most agencies aren't able to pursue their cases using those venues because most states have their own state law enforcement agency group, and they maintain their own state labs that are, for the most part, state-of-the-art. But sometimes they balk at doing certain things because unless there's more than one piece of evidence, it may be hard to use that one piece as a route to a conviction. Even today, a lot of attorneys are afraid to trust only in the DNA evidence. You have to remember that I think it was 86 or 87 was the very first case that DNA was the sole piece of evidence that resulted in a conviction. And it was the only piece of evidence they had. And that was a landmark. But a lot of lawyers still aren't very aware of all of the implications and all of the benefits as well as ramifications that can come from DNA. And using that, trying to use that as evidence for a murder conviction. And you see these guys, oh, well, send it to CODIS on TV. Run it through CODIS. CODIS belongs to the FBI, and they have very stringent requirements that have to be met before they will even accept a sample for comparison. Once a committee meets and decides that they will accept the sample, and they do their own analysis and run it against their database, that committee has to meet again to determine whether or not they're going to tell you what they found, because there may be constitutional issues, legal issues that would prevent it. It's incredibly complicated, far more than it needs to be. I've testified a number of times at trial, and I know that trying to explain it all to 12 laymen, I'm not sure if I got through. Because it's a very complicated and convoluted process. There are no ins and outs because technology continues to advance and we continue to learn things we didn't know yesterday. So there's no way to say you know all the ins and outs. At this point, my feeling has been from the moment I got involved, if enough attention could be drawn to this case that would put it on a national television network or a national radio network, Somewhere, God willing, some person would say, oh, you know what I remember? I remember that night I saw this. There's no one on this planet that would love to see this monster brought to justice any more than I would.
Another theory, though, has been brought to our attention by June's best friend. This theory hasn't, to our knowledge, been explored by police.
The last time that I saw June, I was working at 7-Eleven at the time. And by that time, I already had four little girls. She had, of course, had David. She came in. She wanted to tell me something, but I could tell that she did. But I had customers. I had to get rid of the customers first. And I waited on all them. And she and I was talking. And she said that she had met someone. And she was very excited about it. And I asked her who it was, and she said, well, I'm not going to tell you his name. And I said, what do you mean you're not going to tell me his name? And she said, well, I'm not going to tell you right now. And I said, okay, like that and everything. And I could always get stuff out of her, you know, eventually. It just took a little while. So, I said, well, tell me a little bit about him. And she said, well, we went to school with him. She said it was in a grade above us. So I said, well, tell me something about him. And she said, I'm just going to tell you he's tall, dark, and handsome. And he was a grade above us. And I thought, okay, you know, still going to get this out of her. So I said, well, come on, tell me his name. Well, about that time, a guy that we had also went to school with, and he was a big flirt and everything, and he just came over and he started talking to us. Well, I kept trying to get him to leave, and James tried to get him to leave, and he just, you know, he just wouldn't leave. And by that time, I had some more customers. So I went to wait on them, and June and him stood there and talked for a second or two. And next thing I know, she's waving at me and going out the door. And that's the last time I saw her. So I never knew anything about a guy from Haltom City. Maybe that's where that guy lived. I just didn't know. They committed suicide, supposedly, is what it was. Another granddaughter, one of the younger ones, she and I was talking, and I told her just about all my classmates are, you know, passed away. And I'm older than them. And she said, really, Nan? And I said, yeah. I said, I've been keeping a, you know, a list of them and stuff, the ones that's passed. So she started looking at it, and she said, Nana, she said, do you realize, she said, that these people and everything died 2 weeks after June did? And I said, no, I haven't noticed that. So she pointed it out, and ever since then, I've been kind of digging. I just thought it was kind of strange. It said in the newspaper and everything that he came home, he found her, that she had committed suicide. And then he calls a relative, you know, well, before the ambulance got there, he committed suicide, or he shot himself, and he died on the way to the hospital. I just thought that was kind of strange. I never heard of anybody calling somebody and then, just, you know, turning the gun on itself. To me, that didn't make a lot of sense, but I thought it was kind of strange when I was mentioning it to David, and David said that he remembered that, but he said he thought that it happened before because he said he remembered his mom talking about it. It was just 2 weeks after, because I've already checked it and rechecked it. So if she was talking, maybe she was talking about him in front of David. David told me then that, you know, that, yeah, that was his second grade teacher. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. You know, that would be a perfect way for her to get reacquainted with him. He also was a grade ahead of us in school, and he was tall and dark, and he was handsome. So to me, that just seemed like that was the guy. I thought maybe she might have found some jewelry of June's, or maybe, you know, just, I don't know, maybe found out something, you know, and maybe he shot her and then he shot himself. David said that they did get some DNA off of her, and he's got brothers, and he said, you know, they would probably be a match, but I don't know how anybody would reopen that. Like I said, that was, you know, that's kind of my theory, you know, and stuff, but I did think it was kind of tied in. If that was him that she was seeing, which I'm pretty sure it is, so, you know, how would you open that up? David told me he was a truck driver, and I didn't know that. And I thought, well, you know, if he was driving the truck and he saw June's, you know, thing, you know, maybe he pulled over, or, yeah, you know, I don't know. All speculation, what happened.
And I just, for some reason, in my inner timeline, I had my second grade teacher dying before my mom died. And it was, you know, it made the rounds in the school, and it was, I guess at the time I was told it was a double suicide, or, you know, a suicide homicide where the husband had killed the wife and then killed himself, or something along those lines. And I just always assumed that happened before my mom died. But Dorothy said one of the last time she saw my mom, that, she was working, I think, at a 7-Eleven, and my mom came in to talk to her and said she was seeing someone new, but he was married. He was a tall, dark, and handsome guy, but he was married, and was a little bit reluctant to give her the name. And then one of their mutual friends came in the store and started talking to him, so she didn't have a chance to talk to her anymore about it or get the name. So she was talking about the suicide murder that had happened. And of course, you know, I only remembered one when I was a kid. I'd be surprised if there are more than one. And sure enough, it was the same, you know, it was the same couple, aka my second grade teacher. And then she insisted that it had happened, you know, a couple of weeks after my mom had died. I just didn't think that was the case. And so she looked it up, and it did, in fact, I think the date was March 10th, 1977, when the couple died. And so, again, she's just speculating, but maybe it went south with my mom, and her thought was maybe he killed my mom, and then that the wife found out about it, committed suicide, and then he committed suicide. But again, that's all, you know, really kind of speculation, and maybe pulling two things together that may or may not be related. But I didn't realize, and now I do, that that did happen literally like 2.5-3 weeks after my mom died. So from a timeline perspective, I guess that's kind of interesting and nothing I'd ever really considered. I do remember my mom mentioning my second grade teacher at one or two instances. Why would that come up? Why would she mention? But you know, I was also, she was my second grade teacher, so I don't know. But can you think? I think Dorothy mentioned a coat she got, you know, a leather coat that she got from your boyfriend, and what is that, 40 years ago now? A lot of that stuff would have been a lot easier to figure out and trace 40 years ago.
Funeral service for June Ward took place at the Pitts Dillon Funeral Home in Cleburne. She was laid to rest at the Rose Hill Cemetery, also in Cleburne. But June's story doesn't end there. Though the tragic death of June Ward altered the lives of so many, all of whom still live with the devastation of her loss to this day, she is remembered and loved by those she touched. The following story is undoubtedly bittersweet and can only be explained by those directly involved.
And I think one of the things that was a real big shift in my view of everything was when I met my sister. I didn't even know I had a sister when I was growing up. And then after my grandfather died, and I'm assuming because the family agreed not to tell me while he was alive, they told me that I had a sister. I think I was 18. And it wasn't until I was 25 that I met her. And that was a really, and I think that actually in a lot of ways really turned me around. One, it was amazing to meet her, and she's an amazing woman and great to, you know, it's a roller coaster of, you know, on the one hand, I'm really sad I didn't have my sister growing up. The next emotion is you're really thankful that she didn't have to go through, you know, the things that I had to go through. And then just, it's really hard to describe the emotional roller coaster that is. And she had always wanted to meet her mother, and I'm the one who had to tell her that she wasn't going to, and I'm the one who had to tell her what happened to, and it wasn't my mom anymore. It was our mom. And so I found myself kind of stumbling on even telling the stories. And this is our mom. And it really kind of, I don't know, that I think the net result of that is, besides being lucky enough to meet her and have a relationship with her, is it really kind of changed my, it wasn't just about me anymore. And that was really helpful to do. And even, you know, at the time that I met her, I was living in Houston, about to move to Austin to go to school at UT, and didn't have a car. And so I took the bus up to Arlington, and her and her husband were going to pick me up at the bus station. And I remember standing inside the bus station, looking out the window. And I remember about 50 yards off, a car pulled into the driveway, into the parking lot. And I just got it. I looked in the passenger window, and I, you know, essentially saw my mom and just got a chill and knew that was her. And of course, probably made her very, very uncomfortable the first, you know, half hour that I met her, because I was just mesmerized at how much she looked like my mom and just kind of shocked and stunned by that. But obviously, no doubt.
I always very much wanted to find my birth mother and thank her for what she did for me, because I knew she did give me a good life making that choice. But it was always very important to me. And I'd actually tried to find her before, but wasn't able to. So one day I get a phone call from my dad, who tells me that he received a letter from the agency that I was adopted from, that they had updated information in my file. So he gave me the number to call. I called, and they told me about Dave, and that Dave wanted to speak with me if I was open to it. So they gave me Dave's number. So in the matter of an hour, I was talking to Dave for the first time, which, you know, at that point I knew nothing about June and that she died. And so there really are not words to describe that whole feeling, that very surreal. You wake up one morning and a couple hours later, you're finding out about her history, because I asked about our birth mom, and, you know, and where is she? And so he's the one that actually had to tell me what had happened to her. And for me, then, this was pre-internet days. This was the 95. So I actually, later that evening, we went down to the downtown Fort Worth Public Library and looked up old microfilm. And that was the first picture I ever saw, is the newspaper article about her death. That's the first picture I ever saw of her. And it was like looking at a picture of me. because we look very much alike. And so that was very, very emotional. And it was very hard for me, because in my mind, I was always going to be able to meet her and thank her and tell her I was okay. And whenever, even though she died many years before, I was just finding out about it. So it was actually a grieving process for me that I was never going to get to meet her. Dave did come and we started talking, and meeting him for the first time was, for me, it filled in a lot of pieces about my life. And it was the strangest thing is how we thought a lot alike about things. So even though we've been raised separately and in different kind of homes, it was just very strange to me that there was someone whose thought processes were like mine. So that was just very wonderful. It's been wonderful for me. Even this many years later, Dave and I have a great relationship, and I consider him a blessing in my life. And I'm extremely sad that June could ever know that I'm okay, and that I turned out okay, that she couldn't know my kids, her grandkids, and that she wasn't able to know that Dave and I not only reconnected, but are close and have a great relationship. And I know that would make her extremely happy. And it's very sad for me. It's very sad for me. I never got to meet her. I never will. But it's also sad that she never got to know that the decision she made, that I know was hard for her, worked out well for me, and that Dave and I found each other again and have a great relationship. Well, for me, the whole thing is just that still, this many years later, I found out about June in 95, and still I just have a lot of sadness. So even though I never knew her, I did know her, you know, and she was such an important part to my story and to my life. And I mean, her difficult decision put me on a path to where I am now. And I so wanted to thank her for that. And I just overall feel just sad that her life ended like it did, sad that Dave had to go through what he had to go through, and sad that I never got to know her and that she never got to know me and know that everything's okay. I know he often tells me what a blessing I've been to him and how it helped his life and helped him become who he is today. But I don't know that he realizes how much he's blessed me too. And our relationship is a nurturing thing for me, and it's a positive thing for me, and has brought peace to me. And I'm extremely grateful for that relationship.
If you have any information about the murder of June Ward, please contact Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Detective Jeremy Roden at 817-392-4307. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing the podcast with a friend, or stopping by our Patreon page and making a small donation. The Patreon donations help us cover the costs associated with the research and monthly charges, and we'd appreciate it immensely. We'd like to thank these individuals for their donations. Kimberly S., Key S., Melissa L., Sarah H., Erica H., and Kathy O. Thanks, y'all. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, the bewildering disappearance of William and Margaret Patterson. Please stay tuned to the end for a preview of the fantastic true crime podcast, Guilty. We'd like to thank Diana Kirkley, Morgan Bernal, Dorothy Williams, and Detective John Underwood for their help and contributions to this episode. Also, we cannot express in words how grateful we are for the support and contributions of David Ward and Jenna Howard. Thanks so much, y'all. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Auto Radio, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about the case and post pictures, so please join in. Also, if you enjoy reading about fascinating true crime cases, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. The cases are well presented and always thorough and interesting. TheTrueCrimeFiles.com will not disappoint. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Hi, I'm Colin.
And I'm David.
And we're the hosts of The Guilty Podcast.
Colin's a recent graduate from law school.
And David is a therapist who's treated criminals in therapy over the past 6 years.
On The Guilty Podcast, we tell the stories of some of the worst criminals, and we explore the criminal psychology that motivates them.
So check us out on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also check us out on Twitter @guilty_podcast.
I love everything about you.
You looking at me when you sang that?
Well, of course.
Oh, bless your heart.
I love every dimple in your dimpled cheek, every twinkle in your eyes of blue. I love every little word I hear you speak. I love everything about you. I love every curl upon your golden head, every little place you put your shoe. I love every kiss upon your lips of red. I love everything about you. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, I love everything about you. I love every freckle on your turned up nose, every little thing you say or do. I love you from your head to the tip of your toes. I love everything about you. I love every dimple in your dimpled cheek, every twinkle in your eyes of blue. I love every little word I hear you speak. I love everything about you. I love every curl upon your golden head, every little place you put your shoe. I love every kiss upon your lips of red. I love everything about you. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, I love everything about you. I love every freckle on your turned up nose, every little thing you say or do. You hear me smiling?
I'm listening, dear.
I love every little thing about you, smiling. I love everything about you.